This podcast is an initiative of Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time, DEPO for short, and transnational partnership of over 35 research centers, industrial museums, labor archives, trade unions, and other organizations. You can find us on all the podcast services, and today we'll be focusing on a very special subject for all of us in this room, and the subject is deindustrialization in Western societies, and especially with the focus of Luxembourg and Eastern Germany. In order to discuss this, we have three guests here. We have Stefan Krebs, the leader of Condé Project, and two PhD students, Zoe Konsbruck and Nicola Arendt, who are the contributors. So can you tell us a little bit about the project? The project is called Condé, I didn't mention it before, Confronting Decline, Challenges of Deindustrialization in Western Societies Since the 1970s. So Stefan, tell us, what are you actually doing here?
The Condé Project is a collaboration between the Luxembourg Center for Contemporary and Digital History with the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich and the German Institute for Adult Education in Bonn. We have six sub-projects that focus mostly on Germany and Luxembourg, and they investigate deindustrialization in the 70s and 80s in different regions and settings.
Let's start with Luxembourg. What happened in Luxembourg, Zoe, when we talk about the focus of your project?
My project is specifically looking at industrial towns, but in the broader context in Luxembourg in the mid-70s. Luxembourg was hit by a steel crisis in the mid-70s due to several reasons, amongst others the oil crisis in 73-74 and also rising international competition. And I'm looking at industrial towns in the Luxembourgish southern region, so the Minet region. Luxembourg was affected differently. One aspect is the decreasing production rates, high unemployment rates, and also the decreasing GDP contribution by the steel industry. There are mostly economic impacts that the steel crisis had on Luxembourg, but there were also impacts on the micro level, on normal workers who lost their jobs, but also on industrial towns.
And that, I would say, is pretty common for the industrialization in general. But what was so special about Luxembourg as a case?
What was special about Luxembourg as a case is that the steel industry played a major role in the national economy. So the steel industry's contribution to the GDP in the 70s was 30%, which is a lot comparing to other countries. And this decreased pretty fast in the 80s. Another reason why it was pretty special in Luxembourg is that the government had a big agency and the steel company had a big agency too. There was one main big steel company in Luxembourg that was the Arbeit company, which was mainly the only steel company in the end of the 70s. So this is quite important for the Luxembourg case. What is also important is that there were special socio-political measures implemented after the steel crisis, which contributed to a lower unemployment rate in comparison to other countries.
So before we look at the specific measures and the cities that you mentioned, I wanted to talk about Arbeit, because that's really focus of your research, Nicola, isn't it?
Exactly. So I'm specifically focusing on the Arbeit company, which was founded in 1911 in Luxembourg, and which became over the course of the 20th century sort of the biggest steel company in the country, and also very much acted within the interests of the national state. I'm focusing specifically on Arbeit's activities in Luxembourg also during the steel crisis in the 1970s and 80s. And then I also have a special focus on Arbeit, who invested in an East German steel plant in 1992, when the East German economy went from plant to market economy and was privatized. And I tried to compare a bit the experiences of also the experiences of workers and employees during these two different processes of deindustrialization. So one in Luxembourg, what we had Zoe talk about already in the 70s and in the 80s. And on the other hand, this other process of deindustrialization in the eastern world that started only in 1990 when you had that switch and the disintegration of the Eastern Bloc. And I'm trying to make the argument that deindustrialization has to be seen more as a transnational process.
Anything more we can say about the Luxembourgish case?
I think when we talk about the specificities of Luxembourg, we have to not only talk about the decline of the steel industry. I think what is really particular for the Luxembourgish case is that at least in Luxembourg, in the master narrative of the country, deindustrialization is told as a kind of success story, which is, I think, completely different to most other countries in Western Europe and North America. Because Luxembourg managed to cope with the steel crisis in a way that kept, for example, unemployment rates very low compared to the neighboring countries. And this is why, yeah, this story is told as a success story. It's often referred to as the Luxembourg model. And I think this is why we're interested in kind of digging deeper into the history of the 70s and 80s in Luxembourg to understand if it was really a success story or for whom and for whom not.
There was the Luxembourg model, but maybe not everyone knows what it was. Zoe, what was it actually?
When we talk about the Luxembourgish model, we talk about socio-political measures taken by the government. And one specific measure was in 1977, there was the National Tripartite Conference founded in response to the steel crisis. And there were several measures taken within this conference. And in the Tripartite Conference, as the name suggests, convened members by the government and the trade and the steel company. So three parties discussed on relevant problems on the economic market, but also social problems in relation to unemployment in the steel industry. And one measure was the creation of the Division Anti-Crise or Anti-Crisis Division, or the TEIG. The extraordinary works and workers that were laid off by the steel companies went into these divisions, and they had to do public works in public parks, for example, or they had to do works on the infrastructure on the streets. So those were no jobs that they were used to in their steel companies. So they had to adjust to new job requirements, temporary job requirements. It was one measure. The other thing is that they were sent to early retirement. So they were actually forced to leave their job they more often than not liked, and they were used to it, and they worked for their whole career in their steel mill, and they didn't change that much. Other workers had to change between the steel mills, so they had to adjust to new work environment, new work colleagues, and there were also tensions within these new hierarchies. There are some interviews where people tell us about that they didn't like the new colleagues, or they were classified lower than before in the new steel mill. So these were tensions that emerged.
You change your job, maybe you are forced to retire, but also, you know, the whole path of career kind of gets stopped, right? So you basically start from scratch.
And it was not only for individuals, but also we know from other oral history interviews that in a way kind of whole families were affected, because for the decades earlier, in many families, the sons and grandsons kind of followed their fathers and grandfathers in working the same business, even in the same steel plant. And for long, these families knew kind of what the future would bring. And all of a sudden, that was no longer true. So they had to kind of also reorient the careers of their children from the steel industry to other businesses, mostly in the service sector. So this was also perceived as a kind of crisis also in the family identities, beyond kind of the individual careers of one family member.
And this is also something that comes up a lot if you look, for example, in these contemporary newspapers of workers that worked in the Arbeit steelworks, where they would say that there was a lot of pressure on the national labor market because of all of these people now being in this anti-crisis division. And there's always this big fear of a youth unemployment in the country, because you would not have new jobs who are being created anymore. And these workers in the anti-crisis division actually took over what used to be the national labor market for those who were unemployed or were to become unemployed.
The reason why the model is also called Luxembourg model, because it was a name attributed to the system in the time itself, and the time itself was already declared as a success model in comparison to other countries, because the workers that were integrated in the DAC, the anti-crisis division, didn't appear in the statistics, and that way the unemployment rates were lower. And this is also a reason to why it appears to be a success, even though the experiences from below were not exactly successful. They were quite negative because their lives changed.
So say it once again, the workers were not in the statistics?
The unemployment rates were lower because the workers were in the anti-crisis division or in the extraordinary works. So they were in fact still employed by the company but had to do other works or had to perform public works. So that's why it appears that unemployment rate is lower than in Germany, for example.
And that's what always makes me think what CTDH does best, which is looking at, you know, individual stories, right, Zoe? So in your case, it was three different cities and three different ideas. So which cities did you choose and why, of course?
I chose three specific cities. Of course, there are more, but I chose the most relevant from my topic to make my point. I chose Dudelange. Dudelange had only one steel mill in the 70s on its territory, which is quite important because it was dependent on the tax income locally. Many workers lived in the city itself, so it had economic value to the city, but also quite important symbolic value because it was one of the first industrial towns with an integrated steel mill in the country. The second town is Esch-sur-Alzette, or short Esch. Esch was the biggest industrial town in Luxembourg, also called Minette Metropole, and it had three steel mills on its territory, and one is still working today in Belval, where the university is right now. And Esch is quite particular because the city council knew from early on that industry would remain in the city on the territory. So it wasn't as afraid as Dudelange from the beginning on. So there are already differences in perception of the steel crisis. The third town is Pétange on the Belgian border. And the case of Pétange is quite interesting because it's linked to the Belgian town of Athos. In the beginning of the 80s, there was another company called MMRA Company. The company had two steel mills, one in Athos and one in Rodange, a part of Pétange. And the steel mill in Athos had to close first, so two steel mills have to be looked at with the transnational perspective, which makes the case quite interesting, because the local town council in Pétange reacted differently to the workers' movement in the Belgian town than the Dudelange did. So there are quite important differences between the towns, and that's why I chose these specific towns. What is also important is that the development path, or the development itself in the cities, was different, where Dudelange reacted more proactively in the beginning. Pétange only acted for itself and not for the Belgian town. And Esch had a more passive reaction and was delayed till the 80s. And there were several reasons for this delay and for the different reactions.
Yeah, that's also something we will discuss for sure later, the whole idea of cooperation between the cities and the national approach for sure. But it's also important what you said. So we're not only talking about Arbet in this case, but it's so difficult in Luxembourg not to look at Arbet, right? Especially as we are based here, I think everyone had either a family member working there or there are some links even now. So it's very relevant even for us now.
Even the case of MMRA. Arbet comes in because when the company went into crisis in the late 70s, Arbet took over a major share of the company. So even the MMRA in the end became Arbet.
We talked so much about Luxembourg, so let's look a little bit at Eastern Germany. What did you notice that was different or similar to the case of Luxembourg and Esch and Arbet?
So first of all, I specifically looked at how the workers and the employees perceived the beginnings of deindustrialization, so to say, in Luxembourg in the mid-1970s. And then in East Germany, in Thuringia, in between the years 1990 and 1992. And it became clear that there were a lot of differences, especially concerning timing and intensity of this deindustrialization. So you have, for example, in Luxembourg, when the first steel crisis hits in 1975, when production numbers fall down and when people start to become unemployed and there are overcapacities in the industry. This crisis is very much misperceived in Luxembourg, not only by the Arbet company, but also by the workers and the employees, in a way that they say that this is only a cyclical crisis because the steel market has always had its ups and downs. Also during this period of the Trente Glorieuse, especially in the 1960s, you also had very cyclical ups and downs in the steel market in Luxembourg. So it was really only until 1977, 1978, when it became clear that this steel crisis was irreversible in a way. And if you compare that with the East German case, here you have this feeling that with the disintegration of the Eastern Bloc and also with the German reunification, this is something which happens overnight. So when you really realize, or when not only the company, but also the workers realized that in this steel plant in Eastern Germany, you had very low productivity rates, you had an overemployment, you had way too many people for the production if you would compare it with the Western European steel plants. And you had an outdated technology, which so it was clear from the beginning that the state in which this steel plant was in was not competitive on the international market. So there you can really see this crisis or this beginning of deindustrialization as being something that hits overnight. And that was very clear. So we have a difference in timing and also in intensity, first of all, in these two different processes.
So people were more shocked. You could see that also in the magazines and the papers you looked at.
Yes, so it was more a shock that, like I said, was very imminent and was also at the beginning, maybe there was a lack of alternative perceived by these workers because you had this reunification and the disintegration of, like I said, of the Eastern Bloc. While it's in Luxembourg, you can see that at the beginning, the workers are actually saying that it was the lack of investment of Arbeit during the 1960s and the 70s that led them into this situation, and that you really have a national economic crisis in Luxembourg where the steel workers are the ones who suffer the most. So these are these different perceptions in the different case studies.
And we also have to say that, of course, we are trying to kind of debunk the idea of success story because it was not all the time. But we also have to mention that there were more alternatives for the Luxembourgish workers, I guess, right? Or not really. I can see, Stefan, you're saying like, no.
The question is, what do you think of when you talk about alternatives? I mean, is early retirement an alternative for someone who likes his work and takes a big part of his personal and collective identity from working in a steel mill? Then, working in the, for example, Division Anticrise that was founded to employ steel workers who were no longer needed in the steel mills. They still had work, they had income, but it was not perceived as being as relevant as working in the steel industry. So is this an alternative?
And that's a good point.
But coming back to your question, I think, and this is another big difference between these two case studies, is that you can see that in Luxembourg, this beginning of the deindustrialization was really also perceived as a national problem, and workers still play or refer to this narrative of them being the source of the national wealth also in the country, and therefore really trying to get the state to get involved. While as on the other hand, in Eastern Germany, this is something that is, it's a more regional process, and people do not have this room of maneuver to make their own statements and to make themselves feel heard across, also across their region.
We mentioned Petange, Rodange, we mentioned Esch, we mentioned Dudelange. They are all towns in Luxembourg, but they had very different approaches to how to deal with the crisis and what to do with the mills, didn't they?
Every town has its own reaction to the steel crisis, and the reactions depended on the local context, of course, but also local identities. As an example, in Dudelange, there was only one steel mill, so the town was dependent on the tax income that came with the steel mill and also the workers that lived in the town. And when the steel plant, when it was announced by the steel company that the plant would have to close in 1977, the reaction were quite proactive by the town council because they knew when the steel plant would close, the tax income would decrease and the town would struggle financially. So what they did, they convened an emergency session in the town council in 1977, and the town council itself organized a demonstration in the city, and they wanted to remain an industrial town and counter the decision made by the steel company to close the blast furnaces. So the reaction was quite proactive, linked to its only steel mill on the town territory and to its local identity as an industrial town. As I said before, it perceived itself as one of the first steel mills in Luxembourg, which created this whole narrative about its industrial identity and the industrial town. The narrative was around the image of the Forge of the South, which was created in the beginning of the century and developed itself to the 70s. And this was reinforced even in the anniversary festivities in the towns, and it was a major narrative during the steel crisis as it emerged again. In Esch, the reaction was different because the town knew that industry would remain, and that's why the town council reacted rather passively. They didn't organize a demonstration, they did not convene in emergency sessions to the town council, and they were also in tighter contact with the steel company. They knew that their finances wouldn't be in danger. In the first years of the crisis, this changed in the 80s as their finances struggled nevertheless. And in Petrozsa, it's again different. The steel mill in Arches closed first, but the Petrozsa town council didn't react to that. they were rather passive and only cared about their own steel mill, about their own unemployment rates and about their own finances. So we see that there was no real solidarity transnationally, but also in between the towns there was no real solidarity, because each town just tried to keep the workers on their territory and keep the steel mill active, keep the industry in town, so that they could remain on their industrial path and remain true to their identity as an industrial steel town.
So that's the Luxembourgish approach. Is there anything else we need to mention about the Eastern Germany approach that we didn't say before?
The Eastern German approach was different, but also similar in a way. Different because, like I mentioned before, this was more negotiated in a regional level. You also had requalification measures that were implemented. You had early retirement that was implemented. But you, of course, had this reduction of workforce that happened in a very short amount of time compared to Luxembourg. So in Luxembourg, where you have this gradual decline of industrial workers. So the Arbeit, for example, at one point employs, I think in the early 1970s, over 30,000 people in Luxembourg. The Maxhütte in Unterwellenborn, which is the name for the Eastern German steel plant, employs 7,000 people in 1990 still. And then in 1992, when Arbeit takes over this plant, they only take over 620 of the former workers. So you really have more pressure on the social state in a way to get all of these people new jobs or get them into early retirement schemes. And something that also happened there, which is also a thing in Luxembourg, not as much, is, like I said, these requalification of people, which are often seen by the workers as a lack of recognition of their professional work. Because, for example, there is one worker who says that he used to work in a steel plant at a relatively high position, and then he had a retraining courses to become a plumber with 60 of his colleagues from the steel plant. So he asked the question, but how many plumbers does this region actually need? They don't need 60, for example. So you would see that there was a loss in social but also in professional recognition of these workers. And then there were also a lot of jobs who were outsourced from this steel company, because the socialist steel plant is different from a steel plant in Luxembourg or in Western Europe, for example, because you not only had people working in pure steel production, but you also had childcare institutions, you had a hospital in there, you had art studios and very different institutions who were implemented into this bigger socialist company that were then, after the privatization, were just outsourced. So that's also a way how workforce could be reduced during that time.
And of course, we also can't talk about the national approach. It's way more local than Luxembourg. In Luxembourg, we have the local and the national levels, don't we?
Yes, you basically have in Thuringia, you have the Thuringian state government who is active during this period. And then there's also in the mid-1991, it's the East German Treuhandanstalt who becomes active trying to privatize the Maxhütte or what is left of it. And there you can see that that's something I also mentioned earlier, that the future of the steel plant is actually negotiated between these bigger players, being it the Treuhandanstalt or the Thuringian state government, but less by the company itself or by the workers itself.
And when we talk protest, we also have to mention, last thing, I guess, the lawsuit. So there's a moment when someone says, okay, let's go to the European Commission. Who is it and what are they complaining about?
So the towns themselves did not only act locally, but also on the national and even on the European level. On the national level, they signed documents and they showed this document to the parliament protesting the restructuration measures implemented by the Tripartite. And on the European level, they went against the European Commission and filed a lawsuit at a European court, and they also went against the restructuration measures implemented by the European Commission. The European Commission wanted European members to reduce their production in rolling mills, and this would endanger some sites in Luxembourg, especially the site in Dudelange, amongst others. And they wanted to protest against this, because this would not mean only the future of local sites, but they connected the issue to a more national level. That's why they went a level higher to the European Court. But this was dismissed and this had no real success, and it can be said for most initiatives made by town councils and individuals that they had limited success, especially on the national and European level. But this shows that the Luxembourgish case is interesting because it's not only at the region level and local level that it's interesting, but also at European level, because the distance between authorities was shorter. A lot of members on the local level were even in the parliament or in important trade unions. So it was a tighter network than maybe in Germany. And the agency room was a bit bigger, even though there was no real success and it was rather limited, the outcome.
So now I know what you're looking at in your PhDs and what the focus is, but the Condé project actually has just started. It's like a year old, I think, more or less.
The project officially just entered its second year.
Second year, okay.
But the different project members are on kind of different temporalities. So I think one of the PhD students is now and towards the end of her second year, whereas one of the postdocs just started.
Okay.
So not all six projects are running in parallel.
I'm asking about it because, well, it's the name is Confronting Decline. It's a big topic. So what can we wait for next? Can I ask that?
We just had a week ago our second internal workshop where we presented our latest findings to a group of international experts and discussed the findings and also discussed future activities. We will host another workshop next year that focuses more on popular culture and deindustrialization. That will probably happen in cooperation with the university in Cambridge. And we will organize a larger conference here in Luxembourg in early 2025. But we're still negotiating the date with our partner institutions in Germany.
So all your listeners, if you got interested, look out for that. Look for C2DH, Condé Project, deindustrialization in Luxembourg. There'll be definitely way more to come. And remember that this podcast is part of the Depo podcasts. If you're interested in the subject, do check the other deindustrialization podcasts. And remember, we are available on all the podcasting platforms. Thank you for listening.